The Veterans Affairs Division will come to order, and we'll begin with our meetings, as we always have the last 2 years, with the Pledge of Allegiance. And Representative Rosenthal, would you lead us?
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
And we won't have an official roll call, but my L.A., Jeremy, will be taking attendance as people come in and sit down. And again, we'd like to get started right at 1 o'clock, so we'd ask everybody to be here on time and also to go through the committee chair when we go through the different aspects of the meeting. And but first thing we want to do is just have an introduction of the members, and then we're also going to have an overview of the different agencies, the two agencies that will be presenting to us, Military Affairs and also Veterans Affairs. And we ask that, you know, just tell us a little bit about yourself. How many are new members of this committee? Okay. So we have a lot of new members. And first of all, officially welcome to the committee. And again, I'm Representative Detmer. For 34 years, I was a high school teacher, wrestling coach, also 25 years in the Army Reserve. Retired from teaching in 2007 and retired from the military in 2011. And I was retired as a chief warrant officer in the Army Reserve. Deployed for 20 months after 9/11. And my wife and I also have twin sons that are West Point graduates. They're one is a lieutenant colonel and one's a major, going to be promoted pretty soon. They both have had three deployments, Iraq, Afghanistan, and Rob out of Fort Hood, Texas area. He's going to be heading over to Afghanistan again in February. So just go over to my left, and Jeremy, would you introduce yourself?
Sure, yeah, I'm Jeremy Hansen. I'm the committee legislative assistant for the committee. I served 5 years in the Army active duty with 3rd Special Forces Group out of Fort Bragg. I have two deployments to Afghanistan. So if you need anything, let me know.
I'm Matt Liss. I served in the United States Navy under Pete.
Who won the football game?
Finally. I did not serve any combat duty, so I'm here in preparation to take care of our veterans. I believe that's one of our most important issues. I have a family full of combat veterans, and I intend to honor their service by my duty here.
And Representative, you're the what's your position on this committee?
I'm vice chair of the Veterans Affairs Committee.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's a privilege to serve on this committee, as it's been a privilege to be your seatmate for the last 2 years.
Yep.
My name is Paul Rosenthal. I represent District 49B, which is western Bloomington, southern Edina, portions of Minnetonka and Eden Prairie. While I'm not a veteran myself, my family has served in many, many different engagements, and I've always been interested in the topic, and I look forward to the committee.
Thank you.
Chair, members, Jamie Becker Finn. I represent District 42B, which is the northeast suburbs, Vadnais Heights, Little Canada, Roseville, Shoreview. This is it's an honor for this to be my very first committee. I'm one of the new people, and I have not served in the military, but I have many family members who have, and currently cousins serving in the Air Force as well as the Coast Guard.
Okay, thank you. Welcome.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Dale Loick, represent District 10B. That's all of Aiken County and most of Crow Wing County, well north of here. My background, I served 28 years active duty in the U.S. Navy. I guess that's about 20 years ago I retired. And I've got a son that's now retired from the Army Reserve Special Forces. And my youngest grandson started his first year in ROTC out in the state of Virginia. Here just to support our veterans, and looking forward to this. Is a great way to start the week out every week here with this committee.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Chair and members. My name is John Poston. I'm from District 9A, which is in north central Minnesota, southern Cass County, Todd and Wadena County. I am not a veteran, did not serve in the military, but I've got a long family history of people that have served in it, and I consider this a real privilege to be a part of this committee. It was when they came around to us and said, what committees would you like to be involved with? This was the first one I put down and the one I didn't think I would get put on because I wasn't a military person. So I really appreciate being here and looking forward to this.
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Erin May Quaid. I represent District 57A, which is Apple Valley and a tiny portion of Northeast Lakeville. It's an honor to serve on this committee and to serve the veterans who have served us. I myself am not a veteran. My grandfather was actually in Pearl Harbor when it was bombed. I want to thank every member and person in this room who has served in our armed forces, and I look forward to working with all of you. Thank you.
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Marion O'Neill. I serve 29B, which is Buffalo, Monticello, and Maple Lake. My father was a Korean War vet. My brother was an Army Air Force, Army pilot, helicopter pilot. My brother-in-law was a Marine, and my son is Army Reserve, and he's a Seaburn, so he's a chemical specialist. He was actually at drill this last weekend, and I'm proud to say that he got his equipment in order, and we have 110 soldiers that will be well taken care of because of the work he's doing. And it's an honor to serve here, and I told him, and he is absolutely thrilled that I'm here serving and a voice for him.
Welcome.
Jim Geldman, DFL Caucus Research.
Well, I thought you were getting ready to go.
I'm John Lesh. I'm in my eighth term, which is about what half of yours, Representative Davids, I think, about that. And I serve 66B, which is Como Park, the North End, East Side, and a little bit of Hamlin Midway. I am an attorney in private practice. I was a 15-year prosecutor for the city of St. Paul, and ended that just about a year ago now, January 15th of last year. And I serve in Minnesota National Guard. Oh, but I do want to say this, Mr. Chair. So my first year on this committee was when Jim Rhodes chaired it as part of state government finance. It fell under this was back in 2003. And he got us all rides on Blackhawks up to Camp Ripley, do a little look-see, which was really cool. And I got to sit in the gunner seat at the time, which was kind of fun, to kind of look at Camp Ripley. And we went up there to look at the shoot house that we funded in bonding at the time up on the A-range. And I just had a question this morning from another freshman who asked me if I was a shooter, if I did shooting marksmanship, and I said, well, yeah, part of what my job is in the infantry. And he said, I'd really like to get some people together and do some shooting. And I thought, that's what our National Guard does. That's what they're trained to do. I think it'd be really cool if we got, I know we'd have to have 1-1 safeties on the range, okay, but it would be really cool if we get an opportunity to get some members up there for a range day, even albeit a short period of time, to show what our soldiers do, the basic level of shoot, move, and communicate training that they do. What do you think of that, Mr. Chair?
Well, Representative Lesh, that would be great. And I know we'll be hearing from the Department of Military Affairs today, too, so that might be some things we can bring up in the question-answer period. So, yeah, I think we've already been promised a time that we can get up to Camp Ripley via helicopter, too. So I think that's something we're going to be working on.
Excellent.
So
thank you, Mr. Chair.
That'd be great. Okay. Chair Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I agree with Representative Lesh. We should do that. District 20B, Fillmore and Houston Counties, home of the Southeastern Minnesota Veterans Cemetery. And if you ever get a chance to come down, we do tours. I'll take you out to the Branding Iron Restaurant on top of the hill, and then we'll go tour the facility. It's just an amazing place.
Yeah, I've heard that it is. So, yeah, thank you.
Mr. Chair, members, I'm Lori Pryor. I'm from Minnetonka, Eden Prairie, 48A is my district. I have not served in the military. But among my family members is my dad, and it was the ROTC program that made it possible for him to go to college. And really, you know, without that benefit, you know, our family would not be where it is today. And so I know we need to keep this moving forward to people that serve.
Thank you. Welcome.
Mr. Chair, members, Hu Lee from District 59A, which is Minneapolis on the north side. I have not served, but I have family members who supported the U.S. efforts in Southeast Asia during the Vietnam War and have a current family member serving the U.S. Marines. Thank you.
Welcome.
Chair, members, Keith Frankie, 54A. That's part of South St. Paul, Cottage Grove, Newport, Gray Cloud, and St. Paul Park. I also have not served, but I'm very passionate about getting the veterans the help that they need. My father served. He has was exposed to Agent Orange, so that is something that has kept me close to the inner workings of the VA and certain other things. It has brought near and dear to my heart, along with my little brother, who was also injured and faces those challenges every day. So I'm just very honored to serve on this committee.
Welcome.
Mr. Chair, members, I'm Helen Roberts from the House Fiscal Staff.
And your father was a veteran?
Yes, of World War II in Korea.
Yep.
Mr. Chair and members, Jeff Diebel, House Research. In addition to my duties here at the legislature, I serve in the Army Reserve.
And you're a JAG?
Correct.
JAG, okay.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Brian Cook. I'm the Republican Caucus Researcher for this committee.
Okay. Last but not least?
Chairman Detmer, members, I'm John Hultquist. I'm the committee administrator. I did not have the honor of serving. My father did in the Navy in World War II. And I look forward to working with all the members on the committee and the staff. And Mr. Chair, before we move on, we had a member arrive here that hasn't had a chance to introduce himself yet. And if we could then also have the pages and writer.
Yes, and Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Representative Tim O'Driscoll from the Sartell-Sauk Rapids area of Minnesota and a number of townships in the area. This is my, my fourth term, and I've been either on state government finance when veterans has been rolled in there or on this committee since I've been in the legislature. It's my top request every year. Work a lot with veterans outside of my duties here at the legislature and my other work, and am proud to do that, and want to continue to work on that. We'll have a few bills. Some of them are old-time favorites, and some will be a few new things that we'll look at hopefully this year as well. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You bet. And we have a couple pages. If you would address the microphone there and introduce yourself.
My name is Emma, and I am not permanently assigned to this committee quite yet, but it's an honor to be here today.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Ryan, and I'm a page.
Well, again, before we get into our first agenda item with the Department of Military Affairs, just a couple of remarks that I had mentioned earlier is that this is a nonpartisan committee. We will hear pieces of legislation, bills from anybody that, regardless of party affiliation, if you want to bring them to this committee, we will hear those bills and then send them off to the next committee wherever they go. Whether it's we fall under the State Government Finance Committee. But we also have bills that goes to taxes and other areas too. So if you have any questions about any of the bills that you're thinking about having the House research or put together, make sure if you have any questions, just come to my office and get a hold of Jeremy, and we can sit down and talk about your pieces of legislation, and I could help you at least get you in the right direction. Also, we have another organization that meets periodically. It's called the MAG, the Military Action Group. And the Military Action Group is, a nonpartisan organization. It started about 17 years ago, and I've been with it now for 10 years, since I was elected in 2006. But the MAG, we just listened to different organizations or people, individuals that have issues with dealing with veterans and or military affairs, and we don't vote on anything, but we do talk about these issues. We had a great meeting this morning. Our next meeting is going to be the 30th of January at 9 o'clock in 400 North. And if you want to be on the email list, to attend the MAG meetings, just get your email or just tell Jeremy to put you on the list, and he'll send out what the agenda is, and he'll let you know when the next meetings are going to be. But again, we don't vote on anything. We just discuss things. And a lot of legislation came out of these MAG groups, the Military Action Group. And so it's a good way to get information out to people. You have a sheet in front that was just handed out. If you'd like to know what happened with that came out of this committee and out of the House and Senate last 2 years, here's a list of the different things that were passed and actually in law that we did. I would say all of these came through this committee. This is not a finance committee, so it goes on to other, if it deals with finance, it goes on to other committees. But in terms of veterans benefits, veterans health care, veterans owned small businesses, honoring veterans, these are many of the pieces of legislation and the authors, as you can see. People from both sides of the aisle have carried and been successful with these pieces of legislation. And also the Speaker was very helpful last year in making sure that we get these bills through the House and also through the what happens to a lot of these bills, they get put on omnibus bills. And if you're a freshman, you've probably heard about the nasty omnibus bills. Well, a lot of times veterans' bills do get put in these omnibus bills. And but what I try to do is try not to play politics with veterans' issues. I think it's important that we hear the issue, look at the legislation, if it's good for veterans, and try to get them forward and get them onto the governor's desk for signature. But I think probably the biggest one that we passed last year, we had House File 299. We had various in terms of veterans benefits. We were one of only five states that still tax the veterans pensions. And I've been working on this for about 10 years. Dan Severson prior to me worked on it for about 7 years. And we had different variations of the bill, different versions of it. And finally, we came up with the original bill that we started with many years ago. And we, freshman Representative Heinzman carried it last year for us. And we got it through. It wasn't part of the tax bill, but it was put in the supplemental spending bill. And it took us all summer to let people know that it passed. I mean, I went around the state talking to different VFWs, American Legions. They saw that the tax bill was vetoed and then thought, yeah, there again, it went down the drain. But it passed. In fact, I was speaking for, this was really interesting, I was speaking to a young high school group at Stillwater High School. It was a young Republican group, they called them. And they invited a whole bunch of veterans in to speak. They wanted to hear from veterans. Well, right before I got up and spoke, there was a World War II veteran that got up and spoke. And he talked about his experiences during the Second World War and so forth. And he got done. I got up and I spoke. And I talked. And then I started talking a little bit about the legislation that, as a legislator, what we passed. And I happened to mention that we passed the exemption of the taxes on the veterans' pensions. And when I said that, I happened to look over to that World War II veteran. His eyes got about that big. He didn't know. And this was later in the summer. So I think there's still people out there that don't know that until tax time that they will not be taxed on their veterans' pensions. So that was one of the big things that we carried. And there was other ones, too. I'm not going to go through them, but it's just here for you to take a look at. I thought it was good to give some credit to these legislators that carried this legislation. Okay. The next item would be the rules, The committee rules are not in your folder. They will be. The rules were distributed to all the House members last week via email. You should have got it on the email, but we'll get copies of them in your folders. Everybody should also have a colored with everyone's pretty pictures on there. I keep it close to me because when people call on attention of the chair, sometimes I got to look to see who it is, or if I can't see your nameplate. So keep your nameplates out there so that we can make sure we can see each other and when we're going through the different pieces of legislation. So the next two items is on the agenda are the agencies that we are going to have an overview of, and the agencies are Military Affairs and Veterans Affairs. And I did I tossed a coin first, and Military Affairs won the toss. So Mr. Kerr will be doing an overview of Military Affairs.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, my name is Don Kerr. I'm the Executive Director of the Department of Military Affairs. Thank you very much for taking our testimony today, and Representative Lesh, thank you for signing us up for work. That's awesome. Actually, it really is the kind of work that we want to do. I think it'd be a great opportunity to take the committee up to Camp Ripley. There are some hoops we'll have to jump through, the most challenging of which will be scheduling, and that's trying to work with staff to find a time to do that. Obviously, next week may not be the most opportune time to go lay in the snow at Camp Ripley and shoot M16s. But
yeah, if I can, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Lesh.
Mr. Kerr. If you can get the nicest weather possible for this, that'd be preferable.
Mr. Kerr?
Mr. Chair, Representative, the nicest possible weather will probably come during the deliberations for the final passage of the budget bill, which I expect to be rather later than any of the members would like to probably go to Camp Ripley. But we will work with staff, Mr. Chair, to try to find a time possibly as late in the season as possible before it's obvious that the committee will no longer be meeting. Obviously, that's a window that we'll see. But I would imagine that the committee will be meeting into at least early April, and
right.
We usually can get some pretty reasonable weather. So I'll work with the Adjutant General to get his concurrence and try to schedule something for the committee to go to Camp Ripley for the day.
Mr. Curry, you should also check with. I'm trying to think who's in charge of the museum up there too. They've been working on something too, so you might want to check with them. And do you want to go through your presentation, or do you want to wait with questions, or do you want questions as you go?
Mr. Chair, if it would be possible for me to go through the presentation and then take questions at the end, that might move us along with the most velocity that will allow my counterparts in the Department of Veterans Affairs their due time on the docket as well. I did target this briefing for 15 to 20 minutes. I do have more slides that are necessary to do that, but I also looked at the composition of the committee and knew that with so many new members, it was probably useful for me to spend some time going over the detail of the agency, and so I will do just that. I will call your attention. You should all have copies of the slides in your packet, but we are also displaying on two of the screens. The screen in that corner apparently is inoperative, but this is the agenda I will follow. There is one error on it. I will not have a recommendation for you today. We're just a little bit preliminary for that. But I will talk about that, and you'll probably get a pretty good idea of where we might be going with a recommendation for the legislature with regard to the agency. I will tell you at this time we have no policy initiatives coming forward to the committee for the Department of Military Affairs this year. That, of course, is subject to change should we have things brought to our attention, but as of this time, the agency doesn't have anything that we're bringing forward this year for policy initiatives. I'll start with a little bit of background. The National Guard is unique in that it, under federal law, is a dual status military force. Day to day, the National Guard is under the control of the governor of the state of Minnesota and can be called into active service under certain circumstances that are clearly prescribed in law by the Congress in 10 U.S. Code. So when you join the National Guard, you take two oaths, one to serve the federal government and one to serve the state government. And your oaths are to the constitutions of those two entities and not to the government themselves. Both the Army and the Air National Guard serve as reserve components of the United States Army and the Air Force. They are extensively engaged in their federal mission on a daily basis to prepare to fight and win our nation's wars, and in some cases are actually actively pursuing those ends. We also are a state military force under the control of the governor and be called out under certain circumstances that are allowed inside the state constitution and within state law to support local entities of government and add value to the community. Current strength is about 13,204. We have the Joint Force Headquarters is the entity that exists here in St. Paul under the Adjutant General to help employ the force in state status in Minnesota. And the Department of Military Affairs is the state agency that is responsible to oversee and support the National Guard in Minnesota per our laws. The Adjutant General established six priorities that the organization has embraced and continues to pursue. These are the six priorities. The first one has to do with having our service members always prepared for the missions that they are assigned. The second one, optimal force structure, has to do with making sure that we negotiate with the national authorities to always have the right force structure so that we have the capability of providing support to the state should those capabilities become necessary. And what that means to us is a broad base of unit types that meet the 10 core requirements that have been identified for state active duty support. And Minnesota is one of the few states that actually has all 10 of those core capabilities. This is an area that continues to be monitored and evolves. Right now we're looking at trying to really work some growth in the cyber defense domain because we see that as an emerging field and something that takes a long time to build the capability. So we're working hard at obtaining the appropriate force structure to make sure that we can provide that dual use capability to the people of Minnesota. Sustainable infrastructure is an important priority for us and important to this body because we've got a lot of buildings out there and somebody has to pay to fix them. And all of our armories, with the exception of a few that are on federal property, are a 50-50 responsibility between state and federal government to maintain those. And so making sure that we're doing smart things with regard to paying for utilities and making sure that our buildings are sustainable over the long term is money in the pocket for the people of Minnesota that we don't have to spend if we're doing it smart. Taking care of our service members and their families during deployment through the Beyond the Yellow Ribbon program is our fourth priority. Diversifying the force, it was noted when General Nash came in that our force did not reflect the people of Minnesota, and we've been on an ongoing effort to try to change the composition of our force to more clearly reflect the diversity in our population in Minnesota, and we've made some great strides there, and we're very proud of that line of effort. And our last one is cybersecurity and response, really seeing that as an emerging area, but not only the actual cyber portion, but what things might be asked of the National Guard in the event of some sort of a cyber activity or an event prompted by a cyber attack. Economic impact, you can see only a very small portion of our budget comes from the state of Minnesota. The vast majority of our funding is federal, either direct federal funding or through something called the Master Cooperative Agreement. The Master Cooperative Agreement is an agreement between the Chief of the National Guard Bureau and the Adjutant General that basically allows the state of Minnesota to function as a contractor to the federal government to provide certain services. For example, we run the fire department at the Duluth International Airport. Those are state employees that man those trucks. They're there to meet Air Force requirements, but as part of that deal, the Duluth Airport has their fire protection covered by our military members at virtually no cost to the Duluth Airport Authority. There is some, they do some grounds clearing and snow removal, but basically they're getting a heck of a deal up there. We also provide security at our Army installations that require it and at the Air Force installations, and then we do some other things as well. About 1,536 Army, 709 Air Force full-time employees, 13,000 traditional members, 61 Army facilities, and our two air wings, more than 50 communities represented. We are one of the largest employers in Morrison County and the seventh largest employer in Duluth. I would tell you that the fact that we're only the seventh is a good news story for Duluth. We used to be the fourth largest employer there, and that's not because we've gotten smaller. It's because the economy in Duluth is doing much better than it was 15 years ago. So we see that as a success story. A little overview, the Air National Guard is a little bit different from the Army National Guard. There are two major Air National Guard organizations, one at the Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport, that's the 133rd Airlift Wing. They fly the C-130H3. They happen to be the newest C-130H3s in the Air Force's inventory. They are not the newest C-130s because the active Air Force has now transitioned to the C-130J, the Juliet model, but we are flying the newest C-130H3s in the Air National Guard. We're also flying the newest F-16s in the Air National Guard in Duluth. They have very different missions. Their mission is suppression of enemy air defense, and they also have some air superiority or air sovereignty missions as well, but very base-centric. People from Minnesota drive from all over the state to one of these two wings, and it's not exactly the same when we get to the Army National Guard. The Army National Guard is more distributed throughout the state. We have a number of large organizations, all based on Army structure except the Joint Force Headquarters. We have a Combat Division Headquarters, one of eight in the National Guard. It's located in Rosemont, Minnesota. An Armored Brigade Combat Team that is headquartered in Bloomington, Minnesota. Combat Aviation Brigade, headquartered at Holman Field, with helicopters stationed both at Holman Field and at St. Cloud. Regional Support Group at Camp Ripley. Well, they're actually headquartered elsewhere, but most of their forces are at Camp Ripley. And the 84th Troop Command, which is in Cambridge, and the Regional Training Institute, which is at Camp Ripley. Again, 10,985. Most of the National Guard is in the Army National Guard, and then distributed through a number of places. We'll talk about that in a minute. Camp Ripley is the crown jewel of the National Guard, one of the best-kept secrets that we're trying to make not a secret. It's right in the center of Minnesota, 53,000 acres that are available for training, not only for military training, but a big deal in Morrison County, the economic impact there, $63 million worth of economic impact in Morrison County. Not only military, but also local law enforcement, civilian communities, emergency responders, a bunch of state agencies also use Camp Ripley for training, and we think that's very important because we think that adds value as other state agencies can do training there at much lower cost than is often the case if they try to do it out in the civilian market. Our presence, 61 Army facilities located in more than 50 communities, two air bases. These facilities are available to the public to use, not a big deal in the metro, but when you get out into greater Minnesota, sometimes finding large halls is very difficult. And we feel it's very important that these facilities remain available to the public in Minnesota, particularly in the outstate. Our state active duty mission, we're missing some information here. I don't have the specifics on the state active duty mission types, and I apologize for that. We should have that updated here in about a week. Actually, I just had the wrong person out of the office on Friday to update this. But over the last 10 years, you'll see 27,000 man days in excess of that in support of state active duty missions. Those run everything from fighting floods to wildfire suppression to search and rescue operations and some winter storm support. The structure of the Department of Military Affairs, this is kind of a strange slide, but General Nash, the Adjutant General, is at the same time the Commissioner of the Department of Military Affairs. He then has a subordinate structure, his Air National Guard and his Army National Guard, both have different chains of command that lead up to him. And we also have a state component of this, which is depicted in gray. So if you will, the green is the Army, the blue is the Air, the purple is the Joint, that's both Army and Air, and the gray are predominantly civilian, the gray, excuse me. To give you a little bit of a pictograph, an idea of what our ratio supported to supporting. The little yellow people represent the state employees that we have in our force, about 350 of them. There are about 1,500 full-time Army National Guard and about 600 Air National Guard full-time, and then one little icon representing 100 individual soldiers or airmen. A little bit of a different, not quite the scale, but to give you an idea, again, the state component of our funding, relatively small part of what actually gets spent in Minnesota. Most of this is direct federal funding. Some of it is federal pass-through. These are annual numbers. And a picture of our state operating budget. There are three accounts generally. There are actually a couple other accounts. One is the emergency services account. That is an open appropriation that is there for state active duty. When the governor calls us to state active duty by law, whatever funds are necessary come directly out of the general fund. And so that we didn't list that because we basically estimate what that is based on a calculation of the previous 8 years state active duty. But these are the big three that we track. Our maintenance and training facilities is the majority of the funding that we get from the state. Nearly all of that maintenance money is matched one for one or better with the federal government to support and sustain our armories around the state. $2.8 million in the general support account that pays the salaries of the state employees who are not supported by the cooperative agreement. Many of our state employees are actually paid for 100% by the federal government. And then our third appropriation, the state enlistment incentives appropriation, $6.88 million. And this is a relatively recent change. We basically flip-flopped the amounts that were going into maintenance and enlistment incentives 2 years ago because we actually were carrying a surplus of funding available in enlistment incentives. That was carry-forward money as well. And we felt it was more important to start working on our maintenance backlog, and we asked the legislature to change the formula under which we were being provided funding, and that has allowed us to get a lot of maintenance and repair work done. Unfortunately, there were a couple other hiccups in that, and that is where we may be seeing a little bit of a hiccup upcoming, because our enlistment incentives appropriation we're forecasting to be deficit in the next biennium, and so we may be coming at any request once this session gets further down the road. This is just a little bit of a different look of our funding history. 12-13, you'll notice we actually had a little bit extra money there. There was an additional $3.5 million in that biennium that was provided for enlistment incentives. And then our budgets basically remained flat for the last two biennia at the big picture level. We just made some structural adjustments inside in the different funds. Right now, we're tracking somewhere around about a $1.2 million deficit in the current fiscal year. However, we have internal measures that we can take, so we will not be asking for any supplemental appropriations for FY17. We will be able to find a way to make ends meet. We may, however, be coming back to ask for some language. In the last biennium, that money that we moved, we also got approval to do a one-time transfer of carry-forward money, $10 million that we were able to move out of enlistment incentives into the maintenance appropriation. We've only executed about $5.5 million of that, so there's still $4.5 million available. And we may come back and ask the legislature for the authority to move some of that money back into enlistment incentives. There would be a language requirement, but no actual appropriation for it. But it's too early for us to tell exactly where we're at with that. We expect another couple of weeks we'll have it ready. Generally, we believe that our maintenance appropriation and the general support appropriations are currently funded at the appropriate level. However, we do think that we're going to have to look at the incentives approach, and I'll talk about that in just a minute here. The cost pressures that we're under. So we do a lot of programs in concert with the federal government, and federal government programs have a lot of impact on what we do with our state funding. In this particular instance, there was a program called the Federal Tuition Assistance Program. Trying to be good stewards of our funding, we directed in the past that all of our service members use federal tuition assistance first if they were eligible for it before they came to us for state tuition reimbursement. However, about 3 years ago, the Army actually changed their policy and required not only completion of initial entry training, but 1 year service after completion of initial entry training before they were eligible for federal tuition assistance, basically made them ineligible for FTA and increased the pressure on our state tuition reimbursement program quite dramatically. And that's kind of depicted here. The green line indicates how much federal tuition assistance we had been using. The blue line indicates our state tuition reimbursement use. And you can see where the two lines intersect. The green line is going down. That means the blue line had to go up to keep sending folks to school at the same level. In addition to that, we were anticipating a reduction in the number of our service members that were going to college as the economy improved. That's kind of the general rule of thumb. The economy gets better, fewer people go to school, they go to work instead. That has proven to be the opposite inside the National Guard, and we have more of our service members who are choosing to go to college, which we think is a good thing, because we think that's beneficial to the people of Minnesota to add educated folks to our population, and that's good. We still are looking hard at the numbers, and it requires pretty good crystal ball, because some of our members are very difficult to forecast what they're going to do. But we are concerned that if we don't figure out how to fix the structural shortfall that we have, then in the next biennium, we're going to have some impact. And right now, it looks like about 1,900 service members will be impacted some way. Now, we don't think we're going to have to turn the program off, but what this means is we'll have to make changes to the program. We currently are paying up to 100% of the U of M rate for tuition. So if a student goes and takes classes at any college, up to the U of M rate, they're reimbursed for everything they pass after they've completed the work, up to 100%. We haven't always done 100%, and it looks like that's probably one of the first steps that we would take is we'd reduce that percentage, and obviously we'll try to hit that pretty closely when we start to do that. But this will have a negative impact on our service members, and their families in some cases. We are concerned that there could be an adverse impact on retention. And if we are forced to take money back out of the maintenance approach and move it back over to enlistment incentives, we're concerned that that will just exacerbate our maintenance backlog problem, which is significant. And this has to do with where we're at. So we have a really good handle on where our maintenance backlog is. It's about $140 million, so about $70 million of that belongs to the state. We're not going to come ask for the $70 million at any time because we wouldn't be able to match federal funding with that. But it's a really good kabuki dance to try to figure out how we can get the right amount of money from the state at the same time we get the right amount of money from the feds so that we can do all the things that we need to do to keep our facilities in the appropriate condition. And it's not always advantageous to fix all of your problems at once, because when you put on 15 new roofs, that means in 20 years you're going to need 15 new roofs, and somebody's going to have to pay for that too. So we'd prefer to do three a year over the long term, but sometimes that's not how the math works out between the federal and state government. The boss asked me to put this slide in. This talks about the capital investment history. And we know that there's been some challenges with bonding bills, but in all cases, as far back as we can look, the agency always had a larger request than the governor supported, and the governor's support was always larger than the legislature granted. And you'll notice that the red line stays down there toward the bottom for the last few years. What that means is that any plans we had of using capital investment strategies to maintain our facilities have not worked out for us. So that's something that we will continue to monitor and hope you will take that under advisement when the time comes. Mr. Chair, that completes my prepared presentation, and I submit myself to questions.
Yeah. Well, I'll start off with questions, and just let, if you have a question, just let the CA here know that you have a question, and he'll put your name down. Two questions. Number one, in terms of our security and force protection, remember last session we talked about the force protection of our 61 facilities. There are 60, actually 60, with the two wings, it'd be 63 facilities. I know General Nash has taken steps. Can you just kind of maybe give us a quick update where we're at?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I sure can. So one of the things that we've done is we've changed the security posture to all of our facilities by basically locking them down, adding security cameras. We're in the final stages of upgrading all of our facilities so that every one of our facilities has a security camera so that a member of our staff doesn't have to expose themselves to potential danger to go open the door. That was a concern that we had. We also have taken steps to provide training to our service members so that should it become necessary to arm them, they are properly trained and equipped to be able to carry out those duties in a responsible fashion that's consistent with the laws of the state of Minnesota. We have done some physical improvements using our asset preservation funding and in some cases direct federal funding, although the feds are actually a year behind where we're at and what we've done to enhance the force protection conditions at our facilities. We also have changed the status of our Army security guards at our two aviation facilities and at Camp Ripley. Previous to this year, the security guards at those installations were not required to be armed, and they were not armed. Now those guards are all armed. That has actually added a significant cost, because not only do you have the expense of actually purchasing the weapons and ammunition, but there's significant training that goes along with that, and all that training time has to be in addition to the time that they were already spending on their guard mount. That is, we can't take them off the guard post to go do their qualification annually. It actually results in an additional amount of manpower per year that we have to add to those facilities. So we're working through that. Last year, the legislature did grant us $248,000 in the general fund to help offset that cost. The $248,000 basically gets me one security guard at four different locations for the year, and that's it. We're continuing to work with the federal government through, and most of our security costs for the guards is paid for by the federal government through that cooperative agreement. And that's at Camp Ripley, the two air wings, and the two Army aviation facilities, one in St. Paul and one in St. Cloud. But there are some costs that the feds are simply not stepping up to, and the bureaucracy is not keeping pace with the urgency required for the change. And we're seeing a lot of discussion about, well, in the next POM cycle, we'll have all this fixed. Yeah, we really can't wait 5 years for them to fix the shortfall we have in security. So We're trying to take the steps that are available to us through using the available state funding, but also looking at what other options we have from an infrastructure improvement perspective, adding ballistic glass where it's appropriate, and taking steps along that nature. Did that answer your question, Mr.
Chair? And I know, Mr. Kerr, that I know the General Nash, at a general, he takes this very seriously, and he, I think we all realize that it's a different world today than it was back before 9/11. And I know that our enemies out there, they know that they would love to attack our reserve forces and our facilities along with our law enforcement. So thank you. And my second question would be, these impacts that you talked about the FTA and the STR in terms of the funding for the college grants, does the agency have connections with West Washington so that we can let them know exactly where our shortfalls are?
Mr. Chair, yes, we're working very hard with our congressional delegation to try to see what influence they can have. Part of it is the way the system is managed. The service components actually have some autonomy over what rules they have in place for those. And so we're working both to lobby within the Army to get them to change some of those rules, but also working with the CODEL to try to get federal funding restored so that FTA can be supported at a higher level and reduce that pressure from state funding. So we're working both ends of the chain. That's one of the challenges that we have, is trying to forecast where we'll be successful. And if we're very successful on the federal side, that will relieve a tremendous amount of pressure on the state side. But at the same time, I don't want to undersell this potential problem based on the thought that we might be successful on the federal side, because, it's quite frankly a crapshoot. I'm not sure how it's going to turn out, and we feel we kind of need to follow the worst-case scenario, just at least to make the committee aware of what kind of pressures we're facing.
Okay, thank you. We have another four more questions. Representative Lash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I have two questions. First, Mr. Kerr, things have changed substantially over the years for the Minnesota Guard, including the commercials they used to see where it said sign up for 1 week in a month and 2 weeks a year. You don't see those commercials anymore, even though that's still what floats in people's head, that's the service commitment required. And I noticed on your slides it still says citizen soldier up there. But the mission, as I've noticed for the Guard, has changed quite a bit, including, and I'm going to be vague here so as not to violate OPSEC, but missions that are traditionally active duty missions now being filled by reserve components. And what that means for the young people in our communities is where once you could have your career and then once in a while have to do an deployment and deployment and your employer would swallow hard and say, okay, you know, if you were a good worker, I'd work with you. Now it's much more difficult to do that. And so the soldiers that I know, if you're a high performer in your job, which means you're probably also a high performer in your unit, you're going to pick your job unless you really love the military, in which case you'll just go active duty. And so we lose, I think, our high performers or people just don't join. And so I'm going to ask you, to the extent that you can answer, OPSEC permitting, what do you see do you see a new reality in light of reserve components folding into traditional active duty missions of what the reality is for our young soldiers and airmen and what they can look forward to in terms of realistic opportunities in our Guard?
And Representative Lash, when you use acronyms,
I know.
OPSEC,
you know, I had
Operation Security.
Okay. Yeah, I had a squad leader who used to smoke soldiers when they used acronyms, and they could have said the full word. So, Operational Security is not to disclose what would otherwise be secret information.
That's right.
And as anyone in the military,
we'll only deal with non-classified information.
Yeah, so. Yeah, this is all non-classified, which you know, who knows if it is or not. But I'm just being careful,
Mr. Kerr.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesh, yes, there's been a very revolutionary change over the last 12 years, 15 years, I think the biggest change that we're going to see moving forward, I spoke earlier about the authority under which the President can call the National Guard. Changes were made in the 2011 National Defense Authorization Act that actually increased the access to the reserve components, had added a provision that gave the Secretary of the Services the authority to call units of the National Guard and Reserve for specific training missions in support of combatant commanders globally. There's much more discussion about making other changes to law that will, from the national level, they call that give better access to the reserve components to the National Command Authority, a term that's no longer used, but it suits my purpose today, so I'll use it. We are seeing a lot of exercises that have a purpose in the diplomacy of our nation that may not be directly combat related, but are certainly influential in sending a message to potential adversaries. Our involvement in those, the National Guard's involvement in those, becomes more prevalent every year. And I think that it's a natural evolution to see that happen. But there is no question that it places a much higher burden on our citizen soldiers and their employers. I will argue your point about high performers, though. My experience has been that, in reality, I think that we actually have been the beneficiary of gaining high performers who have left the Army but have a wish to continue to serve. One of the interesting things about living in Minnesota is that when you decide to join the military, you're making a commitment to leave your state and your family. You can join the Army in Georgia and be close to your family because there are all kinds of military installations in Georgia, and you have a really good chance of being able to negotiate an assignment there. So you can really do that. When you're living in Minnesota and you're going to join the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, and the Marines, you're signing up to leave your homestead, your family, to go off and serve someplace else because no place is close to here. And we've seen a lot of folks in our ranks who have left active duty because they wanted to be back close to their family, and they continue to be high-performing soldiers. And I think, honestly, that's part of the secret sauce that we have in the Minnesota National Guard, is we have a lot of high performers who have come here with active duty experience that want to continue to contribute. And my sense is that we continue to see that spirit. Is there a cost to be borne by that? Absolutely. Do we have some challenges retaining? We probably can't retain as many folks as we'd like to because of the operational tempo that we're under currently and the expectations that are being placed on our service members. But service members and their employers continue to step up and support what we need them to do because they understand how important it is to national defense. And I expect that trend.
Well, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kerr, I'd say there's no question there are some reasons that I think make the new regime enticing. For example, the National Guard of the 1980s and 1990s was very different. Post 9/11, our soldiers and airmen are getting better equipment. They're getting better training. If you're hot for action, there are more opportunities there. There's no question about it. The problem is, I think, and I'm just simply looking at this from a line unit perspective, that I absolutely have seen the top performers leave, people who had a bright future in the organization. And I'm like, are you kidding me? Why are you going? And they're like, yeah, I'm going to get promoted ahead of my peers at every rank, but I've also got these opportunities in the private sector. Or on the other side, those folks who really love the military, they end up trying to go SF or, in my unit, infantry unit or ranger or something. I have another question, if I could, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lesh, go ahead.
Thank you. Mr. Kerr, you're aware that, and I think members of this committee are aware, during the interim some pretty substantial things happened in the incentives area and were highlighted out in California of people who were promised incentives and who did the deployments and then didn't get paid. And I have seen the same thing in Minnesota. And I know you're aware of my situation. My situation is a drop in the ocean. I'm still owed $5,000 and wasn't paid that. And the higher-ups in the Guard have attempted to double-talk the contract and say, no, you're not, which is not true. I've been a lawyer now for 18 years. I know contract when I sign it, and I know it when I read it. But most of the soldiers that I know are not lawyers. And when they're told by their readiness NCO, forget it, don't worry about applying, you're not going to see a dime of it, it really frustrates me with the way that I see people ushered through MEPS or recruiting about what was promised and then not getting anything. And I think I sense that the attitude of the National Guard is that it's not a problem here in Minnesota. And it is, Mr. Kerr. I can assure you that it is. It may not be as big as California, but I don't know. I don't know the number. So I'm going to be asking that question this session about where we're at, about specifically how much was promised in incentives to our soldiers and airmen and how much was paid out. And I want to know specifically based on the contracts that were signed, and I hope that I can get accurate information based on that. So that you don't need to answer that, Mr. Kerr, either. If you want to, you can, but I'm just kind of putting you on notice that I'm going to be asking for those numbers.
Mr. Kerr?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesh, actually, be happy to answer that. I won't do it in this forum, but we do have the detailed data that you're going to request, and I'll just take that as a do-out to come back to this committee and do that briefing at some future date.
Yeah, thank you. And Representative Lesh, I kind of heard it was kind of like, it was a personal thing too, that your own personal.
Well, that was how I got into it.
Okay, gotcha.
That's what alerted me to the issue. As you know, in the military, things go on all the time, and the ones that you pay more attention to are the ones that affect you personally initially.
Okay. So, and you were taking care of that.
Well, no, but okay. I'm not going to bring that up.
Okay, gotcha. Gotcha.
Okay. Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is just something that I would like to hear more about. You talked about core capabilities and that it's cybersecurity. So does it look like we're on track for developing and maintaining and those core capabilities that we will have cybersecurity?
Mr. Chair, Representative, Mr. I think it's safe to say that we will never truly have cybersecurity. unless you go completely off the grid. But I will tell you that we have made some significant strides in making sure that we're doing what we can to train members of the National Guard in the skills that will be necessary to operate in the cyber domain. The challenge that I think our society has to grapple with is, well, that we have to grapple with as we're relating to our society is the authority issue. There are certain authorities that different entities have in different domains. Law enforcement is generally not a military capability. Domestic law enforcement is prevented by the Posse Comitatus Act. And so there are some real limitations on what the military can do to protect the population at large and civil and private institutions from cyber threats. So, this is a very complex question that requires a lot of study, a lot of discussion, a lot of thought. But I see the real problem in understanding of authorities and who's got the authority to do what, and more importantly, who doesn't have authority to do certain things, and when those authorities are appropriate and when they're not.
Thank you. President, any more?
Thank you. And Representative May Quay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kerr, one comment, if I may. I had the pleasure of meeting with Major General Nash and the Diversity Council heads, and I want to commend the Minnesota National Guard for increasing the diversity and working so hard to make that a priority and fulfilling that priority. And I think I'd love to know a little bit about how we can be more supportive of that as a committee and as a body whole. But I did have a question also about the tuition reimbursement. I know when I went to college, tuition was just part of the whole cost of college, and if you have a particularly low income members of the Guard, are they struggling to go to school if it's only tuition that's reimbursed?
Mr. Kerr?
Mr. Chair, Representative May Quaid, that's a difficult question to answer because, of course, every situation is different, but a very large number of our service members do find a way to go to college. Their military benefits, and in some cases they are additive. They can use their GI Bill with our state tuition reimbursement program in most cases, although saying something like the GI Bill, that's actually it's much more complicated than that. There are many different variations on that, all of which have different rules and requirements. But our education section, we have a team of people that try to work with our service members that are using the programs to try to find the best way for them, and we're very adamant about trying to support them in being able to seek higher education goals.
And can I follow up?
Representative McQuay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I did get a question from a constituent this morning about graduate school opportunities. Is that part of tuition reimbursement, or is it just undergraduate?
No, we're currently, we will reimburse graduate, student, and PhD, but only one in each, so you can't go get a double master's degree. But we currently will pay for one baccalaureate degree, one post-baccalaureate degree, and up to a PhD and a professional degree, I believe. I'll dig into the detail on that, but it's much more than just a baccalaureate and associate degree.
My constituent will be pleased. Thank you.
Thank you. And Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I also wanted to talk a little bit about the tuition reimbursement, and you had talked a little bit about having difficulty with retainment, but I wanted to talk about that in a little bit broader sense. My son also was caught in the change, and he's Army, he's Reserve, so it may not be exactly what your thing you're talking about, but he was told when he was enlisting that as soon as he finished basic, he would get his benefits. Then after he finished basic, he told, well, after you finish AIT, you'll get your benefits. Then he didn't get them. Then he said, after a year, then you'll finally get them. So I'm not sure exactly if he was just getting bad information from the moment he signed his contract or what. But what I want to tell you is the impact in that was not only destructive to he and his family and his daughter, but it also delayed him getting the workforce. So his entire graduating class that went to college are pretty much all graduated now. They're all in the workforce. They're, you know, engineers and whatever they decided to do. And he is stuck because he was promised and promised and promised and promised, and it kept going. And so now he has at least two full years more to graduate because he was waiting for his benefits to kick in. So if that is, I mean, that's just his story, but that probably is the story of lots and lots of soldiers out there that are trying to make it. And to your point, yes, they're struggling. They're desperate to buy diapers for their babies. Yes, it's terrible. It's very, very difficult. That being said, there are probably lots of soldiers just like him out there that have been delayed going to school because they were promised and it was delayed and delayed and delayed and delayed. And now we've got these men that probably won't get into the workforce for another 2 years or maybe 3 years where they could have already been part of our workforce, which is financially detrimental to them, but also, you know, how desperate we are in Minnesota for workers. So not only is it going to be a retention problem, it's going to be a recruitment problem because they're going to hear that. He and his buddies have already talked. He's got his roommate, so he has a little tiny apartment, but he has to share it with another soldier so they can afford it, and his wife and his daughter. Just to be able to afford a place to live. And, you know, the word gets out. Maybe this isn't such a great idea after all. And he signed up for 8 years, so he's committed, and he wants to do it, but it's been financially devastating for him. So I think that as we have this conversation and how devastating it is for the individual, it is also devastating for all the soldiers that have been promised and then the promises haven't been fulfilled, to Representative Lesh's point. But also it's really affecting our workforce because instead of being an engineer, now he works at Menards to try to make a living so that he can wait to get back to school to get his benefits. So, you know, just to put a face on what you had mentioned about the impact of these changes of pushing it out and pushing it out and pushing it out, not only is it going to be a difficult thing to keep these gentlemen and women, but I believe it's going to be a really, really difficult recruitment thing once the word gets out that, you know, things aren't as great as they used to be, or promises once made are not being kept. And, you know, it's sort of a cliche at a recruiter's office. They promise you the moon and you get a chicken salad or something, you know. So it's a difficult thing. And I'd like to know, has your recruitment also suffered? Because I can imagine your retainment would, but have you also suffered in Minnesota with recruitment?
Mr. Kerr?
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill, no, it has not, actually. We currently are capped at the number of service members that we can have in both the Minnesota Army and Air National Guard, and we are frequently asked by the federal government at the end of the year to outperform those numbers. We actually are tracking well below the national objectives on retention. That is, we're retaining at a much higher rate than we are expected to by the National Guard Bureau. So we haven't seen that, but I think some of that may be because members of the National Guard, that the challenge that your son ran into would have averted that because the state benefit would have kicked in to allow him to go to school and get reimbursed. The difference was the state's paying for it instead of the federal government paying for it in this case.
Well, now, I know last year we passed, I carried House File 841, which I'll just read a little description of it here, allowed active duty military members and their families to bypass the one-year wait and immediately qualify for higher education grants and scholarships. I think I had the wording in there that they had to be living in Minnesota and also active drilling with the National Guard. Now, have we solved this issue we're talking about?
No, Mr. Chair, that's actually a completely different program set. Okay. The problem that we're talking about really is about direct federal funding.
Okay.
The bill that you're referring to had application for Minnesota higher education grants through the Department of Higher Education.
Okay.
And I believe you're correct that the verbiage in there, as long as they were members of drilling, guard, or reserve units and residents of Minnesota, they should have been eligible for those grants without having to wait. And that may be another program that your son can look into.
Well, good. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wasn't going to say anything until Representative O'Neill shared her comments, and I just want for clarification for the committee's benefit. Representative O'Neill indicated that her son was in the Army Reserve versus the National Guard. Maybe Mr. Kirk can shed some light. Is this a universal federal problem that's being pushed down to the state, or was there some misunderstanding maybe that he was in the National Guard and things? Maybe there's just kind of some clarification between the two different divisions.
Mr. Kirk?
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, yes, this is a federal problem. The FTA program is a federal program. Members of the Reserve and the Guard are both eligible for federal programs. Only members of the Guard are eligible for the state programs.
Okay, is there any other questions? Well, thank you, Mr. Kerr, and I'm sure we'll be hearing you in the future.
Thank you so much.
Our next department is Department of Veterans Affairs. We have Mr. Ben Johnson, Legislative Director, along with Brand Lindsay, who is Deputy Commissioner for Programs and Services, and also Mr. Douglas Hughes, Deputy Commissioner for Veterans and Health Care. So, I'm glad they're not asking me to set it up, because while we're waiting here, I think there's one more person we should recognize is Mr. Ricky Campbell. Ricky, do you want to stand up, Ricky? He's a nonpartisan media writer, so he'll be sitting in our committee meetings and putting together information for the public. Welcome. While we're waiting here, Chair Davids, you got anything to add, any stories or any experiences that you would like to share with the committee? So.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, not that we could put on this tape.
Okay. Okay. Yes. Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to let you know I actually visited the Legion in my district last week, and the first thing that they all asked me was to have their pension taxes cut, and so I'm very excited to go back and tell them that it already happened. I'm very excited to share
that. That's right. Yeah. In fact, I would really encourage all of you to seek out your VFWs, your American Legions, and get in there and address their membership, either at their meetings or whatever, and talk about, you've got a list of legislation now that we've passed, and we'll get probably a cleaner copy for you next meeting. But just talked about what we've done in the last couple of years, and that you are there to serve them, and to, if they have any concerns, to bring it back to the legislature here, because that's really our job, is to serve our communities. And those service organizations like the American Legion, VFW, which I belong to both, they do great things within our communities. And I know, and we're losing a lot of them left and right around the state. And then this is something that we need to look at as a legislature, how we can, I see three things. I see, number one, we need to, these organizations need to do a better job getting our young veterans into their organizations, the American Legion, VFW. We have a lot of young veterans now, young families. We need to find a way, or these organizations need to find a way to get these people involved in their organization. And number two, I think this charitable gambling is an issue that we need to take a look at, and the amount of taxes that leaves these organizations that doesn't stay in the community. That's something we need to take a look at. And then another area that I've been approached about is the property tax that these they own buildings, they own properties. The property tax now is that is determined by the county and the city and the school districts. That's really eating into their income that they could be putting into the community. So these are some issues as a legislature that we can to really take a look at. And I know I'm going to have some meetings this week with some different people to talk about the property tax issue and also the taxes on the charitable gambling. So this is something we need to take a look at. But thank you for, you know, seeking out the members and the different organizations that you have in your community at the VFW American Legions, because they, in all the years that I coached and taught at Forest Lake High School, I would always go to the American Legion or the VFW, and if I needed new uniforms, new warm-ups, new things for the kids, they were always helping us out, you know, putting money back into the community. And I think that's something that we all need to, you know, take a look at here. So we got some time here. If anybody would like to share some thoughts, share some experiences from the interim, from the summer.
Yeah, that's true.
Mr. Chair,
Representative
Lesh. I actually personally would like to hear what Representative Davids did over the summer on his vacation.
Mr. Chair, if we already know, can we leave?
Oh, you don't know.
No clue.
Yeah, you have no idea.
Mr. Chair, if I may.
Yes. Representative.
From the, as they call themselves, the grumpy old men and the happy ladies meeting that I attended at my Legion, they did bring up all the issues you brought up with an additional one. They want their hunting and fishing licenses with the DNR reduced or eliminated, or the fees for it, I should say.
Okay.
It's a very important issue to the group. So something we can.
Another one that has crossed my desk is when you get redo your driver's license, that fee would be waived too. That's another one I've heard too. So,
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Representative Lesh.
I don't know if you knew this or not. It was no secret from my part, but I actually opposed your plan to cut the pension taxes.
Okay.
Unless it
Shame
was.
Shame on you. Shame on
well,
you.
Well, no. It only applies to the rich veterans who served for 20 years. All you lifers out there, yeah, you get your money back in your taxes. But there are a lot of people, especially in Minnesota, who've done multiple deployments, who didn't see a dime of that money. And I think the testimony that I heard was that really only 77% of veterans would get that. So I'm not a believer, Mr. Chair. And I'd really like to see how, you know, the incentives piece of this, Representative O'Neill, that's where I think a lot of the veterans are going to see some kind of action of compensation for this. So I'm hoping we can address that. I mean, that's swat over the dam.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
It passed. It's not going away. But I would really like to see how we address solving problems for the other
93%.
Yeah. Well, we have, about 360,000 veterans that live in Minnesota, and about 19,000 are actually retired here in Minnesota. So that's the number that we're looking at.
And
we want to increase that number.
As long as it's Army, Mr. Chair.
What?
We don't want any Navy veterans here.
No, we're talking about all branches.
Okay, fine, whatever. I'll concede that for now. Mr. Chair, you know, all those veterans, they have very different needs on different levels. And so I don't know if we're ready yet. I'm just trying to kill time like they do at the Academy Awards. Are we good?
Brief explanation, no, Representative. Okay. I apologize. Department of Veterans Affairs uses computers that no longer have the capability to plug into the technology in the room. I brought a connection because I had this issue at one point last year. There is no USB. My connection's not working. Our technician is working on bringing me a USB or a thumb drive. Unless anyone in the room has a thumb drive, I can.
I think they have that over at the Senate. Mm.
Military Affairs to the rescue.
So I apologize for the delay, and I'll be with you shortly.
Okay. Okay. Representative Pryor. There we go.
And in the spirit of, maybe to use this time, I do have a question for this morning is there's a bonding bill from the governor's office,
mm-hmm.
and I'm wondering if the components of that are affecting Veterans Affairs, if that will be something that we're going to hear in this committee. Particularly, I'm interested in the trust bridge that is to the Veterans Hospital,
right.
And I know that that's a concern for the constituents in my district, and mm-hmm. wondering if we'll be hearing it in this committee or not.
Well, I plan on hearing before they go off to the military. To the state government finance, I'd like to hear them in this committee because it's good for this committee to hear. How many also serve on the state government finance besides myself? Okay. So I would like to hear these different bills that come across, even though they might go directly to state government finance. And I'll be talking with Chair Anderson, state government finance, to see what she wants to do too, because we do fall underneath that committee. Good questions. Looks like we're getting up. Thank you, 34th ID. And Mr. Johnson, I haven't received a hard copy. Probably in the future, you could probably get us a hard copy so that every member has a copy of that.
Chair Detmer, I will take that for action. My apologies.
And welcome to the committee, Mr. Johnson. And would you like us to let you go through the whole briefing and then any questions at the end?
Chair Detmer, that would be my preference.
Okay, we'll do that.
Chair Detmer, Representative Lesh, I appreciate the assistance there.
And would you please introduce yourself for the record and with your presentation?
My name is Ben Johnson. I'm the Legislative Director for the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. Following Mr. Kerr is always a delight, but in case I'm not as fluent, I've brought, as you mentioned, Deputy Commissioner Lindsay, Programs and Services, Deputy Commissioner Hughes for Veterans Healthcare, as well as Mike McKelney, our Chief of Staff, and John Powers, our Finances Director. So if there are questions at the end that I'm unable to answer for you, I'm going to look to my senior leadership for assistance.
And Mr. Johns, don't worry about it. I came in here probably 30 minutes early, and Mr. Kerr was in here practicing, so he was well prepared. So.
Well, I'd like to thank the committee for this opportunity to introduce you to Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. I'm going to do a brief overview, talk about our agency mission, take a look at the two primary divisions that we run, and then the last few slides we'll talk about budget and funding. To the question that came up about the capital investment, that is not something that I have included in the discussion for today. The governor's jobs bill has been released, and there was some funding included that was similar to last year's recommendation that worked through the process, but I'm happy to talk about that at the end as well. MDVA is dedicated to serving Minnesota veterans and their families. We do that by using proven and innovative programs and services. We're maximizing quality of life and looking to parlay state support into federal support. Our two primary areas of delivering these benefits are through programs and services in the Minnesota State Veterans Homes and Veterans Health Care. Some numbers in Minnesota. VA estimates are approximately 361,000 veterans within the state. This is equivalent to about 7% of the state's population. Of all Minnesotans age 65 and older, almost a quarter are veterans. And when you look at those 75 and older, it's closer to 30%. So aging Minnesotans, veterans make up a good portion of that population. Since September 11th, Minnesota has seen 66,000 new veterans. 43,000 of those have served in a combat zone. This is a breakdown of veterans in Minnesota by service period. The World War II numbers are actually declining. This indicates about 18,500. We're down from that. That is our fastest area of loss. Korea as well, and Vietnam veterans is, as it has been, the highest number of veterans within the state of Minnesota. To the right is a breakdown of veterans by gender. We've got approximately 93% are men, 7% are women, but that number is changing. We are seeing more veterans, and we expect to, I think the anticipation is to probably double that to closer to 15% within the next 15 years. So our focus is to serve veterans in all 87 counties, and the way we do that as a state agency is to partner with our county veteran service officers. Every county has a CVSO. Counties with more veteran population have a larger number of county veteran service officers. But we work hand in hand with our county veteran service officers to make sure that they're accessing state benefits. In addition to that, we are able to use our general fund appropriation and money from the state of Minnesota. We consider it an investment, and it results in approximately $2 billion annually in federal benefits. Now, this is not a hard and fast number, but this encompasses things like federal GI Bill. This includes things like federal health care through the VA, pension and benefits through the VA, home loans, veterans home loans, that sort of thing. So we do see a result in the money that the state of Minnesota supports, the MDVA. We're able to use that to amplify the federal support. Next, take a look at some of our senior leadership who are here in the room with us today. Commissioner Shelto just returned from traveling out of state, so wasn't able to make it today. But I do have Deputy Commissioner Lindsay, Deputy Commissioner Hughes, and then Mr. McKellen is the Chief of Staff, and he oversees the Central Office, which is our human resources, communications, legislative, in that regard. View of the agency, we've got 1,182 FTEs. Well, in reality, we have closer to 1,500 employees, and a big chunk of those additional employees aren't full-time. Those are our health services technicians, HSTs, nursing assistants that are not at full-time, but we are one of the larger agencies in terms of workforce in the state of Minnesota. I'd like to start off by looking at our veterans' health care. The veterans' homes, we've got five of them in the state of Minnesota, and they are, in terms of FTEs, the larger of the two divisions. The health care division supports the five state veterans' homes. We've located all parts of the state, Laverne, Hastings, Silver Bay up on the North Shore, Fergus Falls in northwest Minnesota, and Minneapolis. The way that we work through our veterans' homes are skilled nursing, special care units such as memory, domiciliary, and adult day centers. We also do rehab services, physical therapy and fitness for our residents, social services and rec therapy, work therapy, drug and alcohol treatment, and we have sort of expanded our dental, optometry, and primary medical care, partnering with the federal VA hospital in Minneapolis, which is just across the way. We heard a reference earlier to the bridge that crosses Minnehaha that has been closed to pedestrian and vehicle traffic. Were it open, it would be a straight shot over to the Minneapolis VA. All five homes have been awarded some best-in-class titles. You can see a list there. Some might seem more important than others, but things like quality of food, overall customer satisfaction, recreational activities are just as important. Dining services are just as important to our residents as they are to ourselves in things like overall safety, admissions processes, things that might have a sort of a higher cachet. All of those are areas that we're proud to say we got best-in-class results, both from the Minnesota Department of Health and the federal VA. Now, again, to the demographics, this is particular to our veterans' homes, of particular importance to our veterans' homes. Number of Minnesotans starting 65 in this decade is about 285,000, give or take. This is greater than the past four decades combined. So to think about it in terms of the baby boomers, one in five Minnesotans will be 65 or older in the next 15 or 20 years. That's the entire boomer generation. And that is, for the first time in history, a larger group of individuals in Minnesota than the age 5 through 17 demographic. So K through 12, for the first time, will no longer be the largest group of Minnesotans. It will be 65 and older. That's of particular importance to our veterans' homes because of the clientele is veterans, and our veterans' homes are also open to their spouses. I'm going to get the question later, so I'm going to answer it now. We have a federal cap of 1,058 beds. That's 1,058 veterans and spouses that we can serve. Not all states allow veteran spouses to be in their veterans' homes. We do. We have a surplus of approximately 144 beds at this point, which means that we have the capability to potentially construct a new veterans' home or two new veterans' homes or three, depending on how you want to break it down, in the state of Minnesota. But the federal cap is 1,058, and that's the number that we have to abide by. Not to say that the state of Minnesota couldn't build its own state veterans' home and completely fund it, but if you're wanting to get reimbursement from the feds, if you want to get partnership from the feds, then you need to work within that federal cap for the number of beds we can accommodate. We've made some significant strides in the past 5 to 10 years using both state and federal support. Capital improvements that I'd like to highlight today are two new buildings on the Minneapolis campus, in addition to one that's been open for a number of years. Building 21 is fully operational. It is a replacement, 100-bed skilled nursing facility replacement for a building that was built in the early 70s. It was opened March of last year, and as soon as we opened it, we moved residents in and began the demolition and construction of Building 22 directly adjacent to it. If any of the committee is interested in visiting the campus, we would be more than happy to have you. We will be having an event on February 2nd, Thursday afternoon, that we would love for you to attend and take a look and see at the developments and the progress we've made in updating our ability to take care of our veterans. Veterans Cemetery in Preston is, Chair David's no longer with us, but is in his backyard, was opened May of last year, and we received a federal grant to construct a cemetery in Duluth. Construction began in November. We have a statutory direction to open a fourth cemetery in Redwood Falls, and that will be once the Duluth is completed. Projected completion for Duluth is July of 2018. Some slides that highlight Building 21, which is open and fully operational, and a rendering of 22, which is. Looks like this, except it doesn't have any windows or anything else, actually. It just looks like that, minus the window. The other division within the agency is programs and services. Programs and services assist Minnesota veterans and their families in attaining federal and state benefits. We administer the programs to eligible veterans, dependents, survivors, through activities and services that are laid out on this slide. Federal claims assistance, Veteran Employment and Education Division, State Veteran Cemeteries and Memorial Affairs, which is our cemeteries. Benefits Division is SSAP, Minnesota Services Corps, Vets Preference, and LinkVet. And then our grants programs, which include grants to the veteran service organizations such as the Legion, the VFW, Vietnam Veterans of America, and so forth. County Veteran Service Officers that I mentioned earlier. MACV is the Minnesota Assistance Council for Veterans. It's a group that we work hand-in-hand with in alleviating and dealing with the issue of veterans homelessness. And then Support Our Troops is funded through license plates, the Support Our Troop plates that you might have seen. A portion of that goes into a fund that we're able to use for grant opportunities. And then our Veterans Homelessness Initiative, which was a federal and statewide focus over the last 2.5 years, has received a lot of attention, and we've been able to really make some significant strides in addressing and dealing with homelessness. So within programs and services, we've got federal claims assistance. Federal claims assistance talks about federal claims in pension assistance, disability claims through the federal VA. We are located in St. Paul at the Whipple Building and in Fargo. We work through the appeals process, help develop appeals for VA decisions denying pension requests, applications, and work through with veterans through the federal hearing process. The next is the field and tribal operations, which is, again, we want to work with all veterans in the state of Minnesota, even those who wouldn't normally seek benefits due to cultural differences or geographic location. So our tribal operations work with veterans and reservations who may not understand that they're eligible or may not be able to access federal benefits simply due to their location in the state of Minnesota. But we advocate on behalf of all veterans, and we make sure that we cover all 87 counties. And so we've got both the tribal operations. We also have field operatives who work at the St. Cloud Medical Center, the VA in St. Cloud, Minneapolis, and throughout the state, and are willing to travel wherever they need to go to make sure veterans are aware of their benefits. The Higher Education Veterans Program and Minnesota GI Bill are in place to support veterans, current military members, and families. Provide on-campus resource centers. So we have, not every campus in the Minnesota State Colleges and University System has a campus representative, but we've got regional representatives who can answer questions and help veterans get through the process of applying for college, applying for the federal VA post 9/11 GI Bill, and get through the process of applying for schools and getting into their classes and help them deal with the issues that come up as veteran and current military members who are also pursuing a degree in higher education, or in our case, we also do OJT and apprenticeship. So the Minnesota GI Bill is a last dollar in program. Basically, once you've exhausted all of your federal benefits, Minnesota saw it as an important item to make sure that if someone's close enough to finish their degree but has run out of federal assistance, we don't want money to be the reason that they don't get it done. So Minnesota has an allocation. It's an open appropriation of $6 million. And it's basically $10,000 per veteran. There are some caps and limits to how much can be used in any given year, and they have to have utilized all the federal benefits that are available. But the Minnesota GI Bill provides additional support, it is focused on making sure that the last steps in order to get that undergraduate degree or an OJT and apprenticeship program, we can get our veterans gainfully employed and back in the workforce. Coordinating with our Minnesota GI Bill and our higher education department is the state approving agency, and this is a group of individuals who evaluate education programs to make sure that they meet the criteria for federal reimbursement so that folks aren't taking coursework that isn't supported by federal VA and isn't approved. So they visit the schools and they do compliance checks. They do direct assistance with the facility and faculty to make sure that the education that's being offered will meet the criteria to be eligible for federal money so that they can use their GI Bill, post 9/11 GI Bill. And OJT and apprenticeship is another method that has been developed that has really seen a significant increase. There's a lot of service members who come back from active duty or reserve and say, I don't want to go to do higher education. That doesn't fit what I learned. It doesn't fit what I would like to be doing with my life. OJT and apprenticeship is another way to get veterans back into the workforce, and a lot of them are able to put their skills and abilities from the military experience directly into work for a career. The OJT and apprenticeship program, like I said, is something that we've seen significant gains in, and we'd like to continue to focus on that as well, because we know that the higher education route is not the only option, and a lot of veterans appreciate the variety. The SSAP program, LinkVet, and Vets Preference Act. Now, these are three kind of distinct entities, but they work together. The LinkVet is we want it to be a one-stop shop. We want it to be a number that if a veteran says, I need to contact the VA about my GI Bill, or I need to contact the state for higher education opportunities. I need to understand what's available to me. And if they're not able to get to their county veteran service officer to find out, because that's a sort of our primary focus is have you contacted your county veteran service officer? The LinkVet is a way for them to access that information, and it is a phone that we'll get during business hours, and we're trying to expand it. But it is answered. It's not just a voice line where you push a button and ask for to leave a voicemail. It is staffed by individuals with Minnesota Online to answer the questions and direct the veterans and their families to a resource. SSAP is a program primarily focused on low-income or limited asset veterans and their families. Do things like help provide additional funding grants for shelters and utilities, pay mortgages, pay rental payments, pay for gas if they don't have the money to do so. There are income and asset limits, but it is an opportunity to focus on those veterans who need the most help, simply can't afford to do it on their own. It's a great program. Dental and optical, if you need to get your teeth cleaned and you don't have insurance, this is a way that if you're a low-income vet, and you maybe even have a family, even the veteran and their spouse and their children could be eligible for dental and optical. And then veterans preference is sort of a special program. Representative Howe is not in the committee this year, but it's a particular area of interest for him. Veterans preference is a way to say thank you. It's a way to recognize that veterans gave up something in order to serve, and that they should get preference in hiring, and they should get preference in promotions. And so we've got an individual who focuses on making sure that the Veterans Preference Act, the state of Minnesota law, is upheld and administered correctly and enforced.
We're approaching the five-minute warning. So.
Yes, sir. Well, that's good because we're closing in on the end here. Minnesota Services Corps, we partner with Lutheran Social Services, and this one is interesting because it is and it's access to family counseling, financial counseling, addiction, and disability services. And then our grants program, I saw a few people look up an interest in the grants that are available. These are statutorily mandated grants appropriated from the state of Minnesota through MDVA to the Minnesota Assistance Council for Veterans, County Veteran Service Officers based on the number of veterans in their jurisdiction, and then veteran service organizations. So we partner with, as I mentioned before, VFW, Legion, some of the largest veteran service organizations in terms of membership to help them provide services to veterans. And to support our troops grants, we were able to get the law changed to allow more of this money to go out. And so long as the purpose of the grant application is to support and improve the lives of veterans, it's something that can be considered. So you don't have to be an established nonprofit. You don't have to be a veteran service organization with a congressional charter. It's a program that allows people with good ideas to come to MDVA and say, I have this thing that I think is going to help veterans, and here's my proposal. And it's open twice a year, give or take. And it is paid for out of money spent on Support Our Troops license plates. So it's people saying, I want to support troops, but we're going to take that money and actually put it to use supporting troops. The Veterans Homelessness Initiative, we actually just hired a permanent homeless coordinator. We had a special assistant. It went so well that we decided it was something to make a permanent position within the agency. And we work with the state director to prevent any homelessness and address not just homeless veterans, but those who are facing homelessness, those who are facing the challenge of paying for their rent. We don't want to deal with you necessarily after you've been homeless. Only we would like to focus on the issues that are driving homelessness. and we are down to three slides left, and these ones are interesting. As the State Budget Director, Mark Kelly, described, our funding is interesting. We've got approximately $300 million in biennial budget, and it includes both general fund appropriation for veterans health care and programs and services. We've got the $6 million per year open appropriation for the Minnesota GI Bill. But then we've also got federal funds and other sources. So we work with the federal VA for our veterans that are staying in our veterans' homes. They get a per diem and maintenance charges, and that's how we pay for their accommodations. The federal construction grants are for the veterans' home development in Minneapolis, the buildings that I showed you guys earlier, and the Duluth and Preston cemeteries. The Duluth Cemetery, it was about an $8.5 million grant from the federal VA to do the construction, and then the state of Minnesota will then pay for the operation, the people who mow the grass and plow the snow in the winter and do the burials, and that will come out of our operational budget. Special revenue, the SOT, cemetery and canteens, are veteran spouses can be buried in our veteran cemeteries as well, and then resident trust and gift accounts. These breakdowns, again, I will get a printout for the members of the committee to make sure that we can get this information in hand. Our base budget, we've got it broken down by fund, program, and category. As you can see, programs and services is a smaller chunk of the pie than the veterans' homes, but that really is a result of 60% of that expenditure by category is compensation, paying for our nurses and paying for our nursing staff, paying for the drug benefits, and working with the federal VA to make sure that our veterans in the veterans' homes receive the care that they need. I apologize for the delay. That's all I've got for you.
Okay. Chair, well, just thank you, Mr. Johnson. I know I have one question here. I know we discussed at the MAG meeting earlier today. Just give us a brief update on what the federal government did in terms of the definition of a veteran.
Sure. Okay. Chair Detmer, committee, the federal law that was signed by President Obama on December 16th gave the status of veteran to service members who didn't necessarily meet the federal definition of active duty service or 181 days under Title 10 orders. There are a lot of ways to define veteran, but the federal the change in federal law was to acknowledge that people who served 20 or 30 years in the reserve or guard but weren't activated should be considered veterans. It was specific in that it did not include additional benefits. They're not eligible for veterans benefits. But it was designed to allow someone who has served a long time in inactive reserve, ready reserve, National Guard units to claim the mantle of veteran. It's a title that people were complained about. They said, I've done all this time. I've worn a uniform and boots on the ground for 20 years, but I never deployed. I was never activated for federal service. Mm-hmm. The Minnesota Congressional Delegation was very supportive of it and said, all right, we're not going to add a bunch of benefits for you to be eligible to, and it doesn't apply to Minnesota definition for veterans, but it allows people who have served in some capacity wearing a uniform to be considered veterans, to call themselves veterans and have no shame in doing so.
And we got one last question. Representative Poston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Johnson. You mentioned the 1,058 cap, and I've got a couple of questions for you on that. One, are all those beds filled today, or is a certain percentage of them filled today? Is there a waiting list? And how is that cap determined?
Mr. Johnson.
Chair Detmer, Representative Poston, we have not met that cap. We currently operate the five veterans' homes. There is a waiting list. For all five veterans' homes, the longest list obviously is Minneapolis because the metro area has the largest concentrations of veterans in the state of Minnesota. But all five homes do have a waiting list of some sort. We have basically the capacity for about 950 beds at present. We have the ability to add about 144 more beds in the form of new beds, new facilities. And we operate, I'm going to ask Deputy Commissioner, how many do we have at present in terms of residents? Do you I hate to put him on the spot, but I know the numbers help. So we do have the ability to.
When you're new in the job, we always put you on the spot. You know, welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself.
My name is Deputy Commissioner Douglas Hughes. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to answer that by just giving you the raw numbers, and that is in Hastings, they have 200. In the Minneapolis, currently 291, but that'll be rising when the building 22 opens up. In Fergus, there's about 90. In in Laverne, there's about 90. And in Silver Bay, about 90.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you. Representative Polston, any other questions?
Just one other quick question. I was at an organization called the Eagles Healing Nest in Sauk Center a week ago, and they have 40 to 50 veterans that are living there and getting help, getting counseling, getting different types of help. And I'm wondering why a place like that even has to exist.
Well, I would say that if we were to build so many homes, I don't know that we would ever be able to reduce our waiting list to zero. I don't know that would ever be possible. In addition to that, we do have federal caps on what is allowed in the state, because a lot of those caps are tied to the reimbursement that we get. We have reimbursement that is assigned for each, whether it's adult day, whether it's the domiciliary, which is down in Hastings. We also have a domiciliary at Minneapolis. And whether you're a highly service-connected veteran, 70% or greater, and there's some other nuances in there too, or not. So the federal government, is, as one of the slides previously showed, does have quite a bit of funding that comes to us. So it would all have to be approved by the federal government, because they're the ones, especially when it comes to construction. Construction is 65% feds and 35% state.
And Representative Polston, and thank you, Mr. Hughes. I think that the Eagle's Nest, it's the oversight of that organization is the county. Am I right on that? No? It is?
Chair Demery, yep. It's self-contained. The oversight is completely within themselves.
I know they've gotten some state grants, some money from the legislature. So.
Yes. They do. They're good partners. They do a good job with the kinds of people who have served that simply haven't been able to get into the VA system, whether it be the status of their discharge or the status of their service. The Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs works with veterans as defined by Minnesota statute. And it is a little convoluted, and as Representative Detmer pointed out, we talked a bit about it at the MAG meeting this morning. We're working to make it easier to understand and apply the state law to an individual service to understand if they're veterans and eligible to get into the veterans' homes. As Deputy Commissioner Hughes laid out, the waiting list and based on the data and the population metrics over the next 15 years, there simply is never going to be enough beds available within the state agencies, within MDVA, to house all the veterans who would like to stay in a state veterans' home. I neglected to answer your question from earlier. The 1,058 is based on demographics. You look at a state like Minnesota with 361,000 veterans. You look at a state like Arizona or Georgia, Florida, some of these Sun Belt states, their veterans populations are well over the million and a half. So the way that the feds determine who is a veteran and where the states get priorities, it's veterans population and one of the things that was passed last year was to try and improve Minnesota's standing as a place to return to and come back. Mm-hmm. A hat tip to Representative Detmer and his work on the pension tax exemption. If we can become a place where veterans want to retire to and come home to and improve the number, increase the number of veterans in the state, we might be able to address the federal cap. But It's unlikely. There are places that veterans would rather retire.
And we're going to cut it off there. And thank you, Mr. Johnson and Mr. Hughes, for coming in. And welcome to the team.
Thank you.
That you've joined. And our next meeting is going to be Monday, January 23rd, our next committee meeting. And so This meeting now adjourned.